Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today, two guests. Firstly is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University, and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt. This is episode CXXXIII, Anthology of Interest II. That's right, for the second time, we are taking three Roman topics of interest each and presenting them for 3 minutes. The ultimate triumvirate, if you will.
Three people, two experts and me, with three things of Roman-related interest for 3 minutes each. So, Rhiannon, you are going first. Hello.
Hello. Scaurus and the Marble Columns is my story.
Off you go.
Marcus Aemilius Scaurus. He was Sulla's stepson, but that is much beside the point. He was aedile in 58 BCE, and part of his job was to look after entertainment, and he put on very lavish entertainments. This included building a temporary theatre for the production of plays. There was at this point no stone theatre in Rome. We know that because famously it didn't happen until 55 BCE with the Theatre of Pompey. So this was a wooden structure, and even though it was wooden, Scaurus showed off by importing and placing 360 marble columns of Lucullan marble on the stage. This is a black marble, which was much beloved by the politician Lucullus, also known for his luxury. It's actually, though, from Teos, a Greek island. I'm not sure this is possible. I feel like it would collapse the stage, but maybe the Romans could actually do this. And Pliny the Elder is very certain of it in Book 36, Chapter 5. He says, when Marcus Scaurus was aedile, there was the spectacle of 360 columns being taken onto the stage of an improvised theatre, which was intended to be used for barely a month. And the laws were silent, says Pliny. He gets a moralistic little jibe in at every stage. Now, of course, Scaurus does this to impress the public. He wants to win support in case he stands for any future elections. Pliny, however, thinks of this as a real cardinal sin. Not only is he vulgarly displaying wealth, but then worse, he takes the columns which were on public display and puts them into his own house on the Palatine Hill. This makes private houses, says Pliny, more lavish than the temples of the gods with their mere terracotta decorations at that time, which we know is not true.
Yes.
58 BC, they weren't only decorated with terracotta, but Pliny gets to make his point. Later on, a chapter or two later, Pliny tells us that a drain contractor forced Scaurus to give him security against damage to the city's drains while the columns were being dragged to the Palatine, to Scaurus's house. Mm. But where, says Pliny, is the security against immorality? So, yes, every little stage he'll talk about how awful this is for our morals. Now, unfortunately for Scaurus, the columns and the other extravagant displays which he put on in 58 cost him much of his vast fortune. It cost a lot of money to bring this stuff in. So when he became governor of Sardinia, he later tried to recoup his losses.
As you do, yeah.
Well, yeah, basically by stealing, by extorting from the local populace.
Mm.
This left him vulnerable to prosecution, as happens with so many other Republican politicians after his office. And indeed, he was prosecuted. He was defended successfully by Cicero. And some of our information comes from the fragments of this speech. In fact, Cicero makes a joke. I think it's a joke about how he's going to put Alban columns in his donkey panniers. It's a joke I don't really understand, but it clearly refers to this incident.
It's a Cicero joke.
In the end, Scaurus seems to have made an enemy of Pompey. He ends up being forced into exile. The columns had a different fate. They became part of the Augustan makeover of Rome. They went back to the theatre when Augustus built, actually finished off a project of Julius Caesar, his grand new theatre and named it after his nephew Marcellus.
Mm, Theatre of Marcellus.
Exactly. So that's where they ended up.
And they're not still there today, of course.
It's private residences. It's been a palace. Everything's been taken out of it. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Everything of value ends up in a Pope's backyard. Okay, very good. Next thing of interest is coming from me, the Portland Vase, which is in the British Museum, part of their collection. It's a Roman cameo glass dates back to early 1st century CE, which is when all the Roman cameo glasses are from, because that's when they were doing that technique, which I won't go into in my 3 minutes. It is dark blue and white. The scenes are open to interpretation. Some think there's Cleopatra on there. Mm. Yeah, some get quite involved with different goddesses and what have you. But this vase is interesting to me because I like that. One is it shows you how important archaeological context is, because we don't know where exactly it's from. It's believed to have been found in what was once thought to have been the sarcophagus of Severus Alexander and his mother, in what was once believed to have been his tomb. But now none of that is trusted. So, no. we've got this Roman vase without any context in the museum. But it is very nice. The fourth Duke of Portland, the vase is named after his seat, do we call them seats? Peerage.
Yeah, I guess.
Lent it to the museum to be part of their permanent collection, and they later bought it. He lent it to them in 1810 because it got broke by the Duchess of Gordon for the third time at that point. And this is how, I don't know how anything survived early antiquarian days, because they were just so careless with things. So in 1845, an Irishman named William Lloyd picked up a large lump of Rhiannon. How do I pronounce this?
Basalt.
Basalt. Thank you. Somebody would almost think that I've been corrected in an earlier recording. It's part of a monument from the ruin of Persepolis, and smashed the vase and its case, well, smashed the vase into more than 200 pieces. So since that day, it's been restored a few times over many, many years. He said that he had been drinking all week, and he couldn't be punished for this because there was a loophole in the law that his lawyers managed to get him through, which said he couldn't be punished if he's broken something that's worth more than £5. Mm. And the vase clearly is that. So they got him on the breakage of the case, right, and fined him £3, which was paid anonymously by mail. And they actually think that his name might have been a false name. And there's all these conspiracy theories, as there would be, online. So he was arrested and charged with willful damage for that. The first restoration of the Portland vase had 37 fragments left over, which were put in a bottom drawer and lost for many years. And a more recent restoration leaves all but a few splinters integrated, and they just kind of filled in the gaps where they were. And they found that the base isn't the original base.
Okay.
It's a much more interesting cameo base that was later fixed on. Mm. So it's now displayed separately as well. Mm. So there you go.
Sounds like when I make IKEA furniture and there's always bits left.
All right, so that is my thing of interest. 3 minutes three. There you go.
Oh, well done.
Yeah, better than last time.
We just need to record twice.
Yeah. Shh. We are still recording. We are recording. That's good. Okay. Kaelin, I have a feeling that your first thing of interest might have to do with Claudius.
It does, yes, because I ragged on him a bit last time about his stupidity, or at least stories about his stupidity, but he's always a great source of anecdotes. So I have some stories from Suetonius' life of Claudius about his paranoia and suspicion. And I think I'd be suspicious too if I became emperor when found cowering behind a curtain by the Praetorian Guard. According to Suetonius, when people came to see him at the palace or came to dinners, Claudius himself never went there except being surrounded by guards and having soldiers wait on him in place of servants. And Suetonius also says he never visited a man who was ill without having the patient's room examined beforehand and his pillows and bed clothing felt over and shaken out. Make sure there were no hidden weapons in there. And then everyone who came to see him at the palace to pay their respects was searched. Even, Suetonius says, women and young boys and girls were grossly mishandled by the staff there, and that scribes had their pens and styluses confiscated.
Wow.
Because, you know, a stylus dangerous could be weapon. A dangerous weapon.
Wow. Yeah, pen is mightier.
Exactly. So he was also suspicious of people who had dreams about him, and sometimes callers to the palace exploited this. So we have this story from Suetonius Claudius 37, when a man who was involved in a lawsuit came to pay his respects and took Claudius aside and told the emperor that he had had a dream that the emperor would be murdered by a certain individual, but he didn't give further details. Then later, the opponent in the lawsuit turned up to pay his respects, and our man pointed him out, saying, "That's the man who I dreamt about that was going to kill you, Claudius." Claudius had this petitioner seized, as if caught red-handed, Suetonius says, and taken off and executed. I think that goes to show that stories about Claudius's paranoia and suspicion could be exploited by other people for political gain or legal gain.
Mm. Yeah, so you don't want a sickbed visit from the emperor and also dangerous going into his presence at all to petition.
Yeah, it's hard to fault Claudius. He had been through a fair bit at that point. And, you know, he more than anyone else was probably very surprised when he became emperor.
Yeah, I think so, yes. Yeah.
Thank you, Kaelin. Very much of interest. Rhiannon, do you have another of interest? Do you have a segue of interest from the...
Well,
from...
I might go to my third one because it involves an author who's possibly of Claudian period.
Oh.
Also the Irish who came up in the Portland Vase. The Irish are not going to come out well out of this, although it's very unreliable.
Shout out to Ireland.
This is not so much a story as something that fascinates me. So I thought I'd look at Britannia and Hibernia, or Britain and Ireland, in a couple of early imperial geographies. Mm. Start with Strabo. Strabo's writing maybe in the 20s CE. Now, he has very little to say on the Britons, which I think is quite telling in itself. We should remember, I should briefly contextualize this, that Julius Caesar had two brief campaigns in Britain in 55 and 54 BCE, but Britain doesn't become a province until Claudius in 43. So this is pre the province. This is pre-invasion. He doesn't know much about them, but he says they have no cheese making. Ooh. That's important. Yeah. No agriculture, which I think is bigger. And worst of all, no cities. Oh. This is Strabo's Geography, Book 4, 5-2. They merely fence in a broad circle with felled trees and make an enclosure for their cattle. But even this primitive structure isn't permanent, he says. He really has nothing good to say about the Britons. He regards it, and this, I guess, is the point, as not worth conquering. So Caesar did the right thing by not bothering. It has no natural resources to offer. He's quite wrong about this. When they, they find plenty of tin and iron and other things to exploit. The paucity of fertile land combined with a completely hostile climate, there's so much rain and fog that Strabo says, I quote, "Throughout the day, the sun is to be seen for only 3 or 4 hours round about midday." I'm going to not do Ireland until the end. I'm going to move on to a slightly later geographer called Pomponius Mela, who not many people heard of, who wrote a Chorographia in 3 books. Now, the interesting thing about him is we don't know exactly his date. He maybe wrote under Caligula, but is more probably Claudius. And we can date him only really by his comments that the current emperor is opening up Britannia. Which might refer to Caligula's intention to do it, which went very badly wrong in, remember, collecting the seashells.
Mm-hmm.
But more likely people think a Claudian date because he actually did open up Britannia. Mela says in Book 3, Chapter 52, this always cracks me up, that Britannia is triangular and very much like Sicily. He means the shape, not anything about the environment, clearly. Britain is flat, huge, fertile, but better for what feeds sheep than sustains humans. So a bit of a put down there. You can't do proper agriculture. Mm. It supports peoples and their kings, but they are all uncivilized. That's it, full stop. Farther from the sea, the more ignorant they are, he says, which does actually mirror something that Caesar says about them. Okay, so now I'm going to move on to Ireland and see what both of these have to say. I'm going to do them in the other order and start with Mela on Ireland. This is in the following chapter, chapter 53 of Book 3. On the far side of Britannia is Euerna. He doesn't call it Hibernia, which is weird. Its climate is hideous for ripening seeds. So you don't get any agriculture there. But the island is so luxuriant with grass that sheep stuff themselves in a fraction of a day. And unless they are kept from the pasture, they burst from feeding too long.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't think he knows much about Ireland. Remember, the Romans never invaded. Yeah, the sheep burst there. You've got to keep them off that pasture. Its inhabitants, he said, are undisciplined and ignorant of all virtue to a greater degree than any other nation. And they are very much inexperienced in piety. Now, this text was revised in the manuscript, which is part of why I'm interested in this. There's a scribe's gloss that says, at least they know virtue to some degree, which commentators say this is probably an Irish scribe or somebody sympathetic to the Irish, that they can't stand the fact that Mela writes this. Strabo, however, on Ireland is much, much weirder. Now, remember, he's the earlier author, and the Romans didn't even have that much experience of Britannia at this stage, let alone know what was going on in that further island of Ireland. So book four, chapter five, he says, besides some small islands around Britain, there's a large island, Ierne, he calls it. I have nothing certain to tell about it, but he tells us anyway. Its inhabitants are more savage than the Britons, since they are man-eaters as well as heavy eaters.
Okay.
We don't really know what he means by heavy eaters. They eat a lot.
They eat a lot
of men.
That's
a literal translation. And since further, they count it an honourable thing when their fathers die to devour them. And openly to have intercourse, not only with other women, but also with their mothers and sisters. So they're cannibals and they're incestuous. However, I will finish by saying that Strabo then goes on to say, I'm only saying this with the understanding I have no trustworthy witnesses for it. As for man-eating, he says, it's what the Scythians and other people do. So, you know, he's basically saying it's weird travellers' tales about the edges of the earth without coming out and saying that. I fear that I went on for a lot more than 3 minutes.
Yeah, you did. But that was of interest.
And it did have exploding sheep, which I just think were amazing.
I kind of like the exploding sheep better than the cannibals in a way. Yes.
All right, so Rhiannon, apologise to the Irish listeners.
As I say,
on behalf of Strabo,
he's clearly even admitting that it's more or less made up.
Caelan, did you want to do an of interest now?
I have an interest from the other end of the empire. So we're going from Ireland to Cilicia, which is in southern Turkey today. And this is a story about a sophist who came from Cilicia. And this is Alexander, who was nicknamed the Clay Plato. Pello Platon. We know about him from Philostratus' Lives of the Sophists, who has all these wonderful stories about these travelling rhetors who have to give off-the-cuff speeches, pretending to be Demosthenes and talking in pure Attic Greek, but they also go on embassies before the emperor to speak on behalf of their hometowns. So the fact that he has the nickname Clay Plato suggests that his speeches were philosophical in nature. Perhaps they didn't also measure up to Plato's own works. Clay Plato suggests that he was but a rude copy of the philosopher. Indeed, another sophist, when listening to Alexander's speeches, this is Skeptus of Corinth, said that he had found the clay but not the Plato, which I think is a bit of a damning judgment.
That was a one-star review.
So Philostratus has some wonderful details of how beautiful Alexander was. He had a curly beard of moderate length, his eyes large and melting, his nose well-shaped, his teeth very white, his fingers long and slender. So I sort of imagine him as sort of like a second century AD hipster or something like that with a long beard, but all perfectly groomed at the same time. And he went on an embassy to the emperor Antoninus Pius on behalf of his home city. And of course, Antoninus is known for being a mild and generous and just emperor. And it was even rumoured that Alexander used artificial means to make himself look younger. So perhaps a forerunner of plastic surgery or something like that.
I wonder what that means.
I don't know.
Some sort of mask, maybe.
A mask or injections of things, I don't know. Alexander is a bit of a show pony. He goes and, you know, performs before Antoninus Pius. And apparently the emperor isn't paying attention to him. So Alexander raised his voice and said, "Pay attention to me, Caesar." And according to Philostratus, Antoninus was very annoyed and retorted, "I am paying attention, and I know you well. You are the fellow who is always arranging his hair, cleaning his teeth, and polishing his nails, and always smells of perfume." A classic put down there from Antoninus Pius.
Yeah.
It's probably apocryphal. The anecdote is designed to tell us more about some of the sophists than Antoninus himself.
It's also one star.
It's very much a one star review there.
Well, it also tells us that he could see through somebody's vanity and surface appearance, I guess.
Which is quite nice for a man who apparently wore, you know, simple clothes himself. Mm. And yeah, he didn't like pomposity.
Yes.
All right, I can segue from that. Where did you say he was from?
Cilicia in southern Turkey.
Okay, I've got Syria. So 256 CE, which is the reign of Gordian the Third, I'm going to say.
256 is Valerian.
Valerian. Yes. I'm going to say Valerian and go with the academic nothing. Expert.
nothing to do with Game of Thrones.
Okay. So the Romans held the Syrian city of Dura Europus, which backs onto the Euphrates River. It is well fortified with thick walls, lots of mud brick and so forth around there. The Persians decide that they would like to take this city, so they set about digging a tunnel under the walls from a nearby Acropolis. So they've got a handy hole there, decided to dig a long tunnel. I know I had a go at the Gauls doing this in Caesar's Gallic War, but now I believe that this sort of thing happened. So the Romans hear the tunneling. They hear the tunneling coming. We know that something's on, so they decided to dig a counter tunnel in the opposite direction and see if they can intercept the Persians. This isn't going to have a happy ending.
It sounds like it's going to be a comedy episode.
No. So the Romans are just above the Persian tunnel, so they knock down into the Persian tunnel. The Persians, you know, you got to think that both of them are digging in black and everything like that, but they can hear the others digging towards them, so they anticipate this is coming. So they set a fire and they throw sulfur and bitumen on that fire just as the Romans break through. So this is one of the earliest examples of chemical warfare. Mm. So the resulting gas kills all 19 Roman soldiers who are in the tunnel, as well as one Persian who I'm assuming was the unlucky guy who drew the short straw to actually throw the bitumen and the sulfur onto the fire. Yeah, early example of chemical warfare. So this was found during excavations in 1920s that the French did. And also in this Roman city / not Roman city of Dura Europus was one of the earliest Christian churches, which had been converted from a house, and it had a painting which is believed to be the earliest depiction of Christ, which is now in Yale in a museum, which is kind of good because that whole city's pretty much been plundered and wiped out by ISIS in 2014. So there you go. Chemical warfare, plundering, looting, etc. That's my second thing of interest.
Wow.
Yeah. The 19 soldiers could still potentially be there because they were reburied.
Right.
After the initial excavation and everything. The tunnels were filled back in. Yeah. So the Persian was in all of his armor. There was a horse there in full armor, not in that tunnel, but, you know, just outside that, and wooden shields and everything, and, you know, quite a lot found there, but all been reburied. So possibly all plundered, possibly still there.
I think one of the wooden shields is in the Yale Art Gallery, so you can go and see it there.
Who wants to go next?
I have a 4th century AD one.
We're going later. Mine's Seneca.
That's okay. My other one's Nazis.
So. Looking forward to the Nazis. I don't mind. You go, Caleb.
Okay, yes. Well, mine is about the death of the Emperor Valentinian I in 375. So this might be considered a spoiler for a future episode, though since if we get up that far, it won't be till 2025 or so.
You'd
have forgotten. So it's one of the interesting death scenes. So Valentinian I was a Pannonian emperor, a former military officer, and he was famed for his savagery. And here I'm drawing on the history of Ammianus Marcellinus, whose res gestae, which simply means, you know, things that happened, history, went from where Tacitus left off from the reign of Nerva all the way up to Theodosius I. The first 13 books are lost, so it starts again in the reign of Constantius II. But it's a great history written in Tacitian style. So he tells us about Valentinian I, who apparently had two savage man-eating she-bears, which he placed in cages outside his bedroom, one of which was called Goldflake and the other Innocence, and apparently had trustworthy keepers to guard them. The pièce de résistance is, finally, after he had seen the burial of many corpses of those whom Innocence had torn to pieces, he allowed her to return to the forest unhurt as a good and faithful servant in the hope that she would have cubs like herself. So she was released back into the wild. That story strains credulity, but I think the names are quite amazing. Even better is Valentinian I's death scene. He dies actually ranting against ambassadors from the Quadi who come before him begging for peace and forgetfulness of their past offences. And they give a series of excuses to Valentinian. Ammianus continues, At this, the emperor burst into a mighty fit of wrath. And being particularly incensed during the first part of his reply, he railed at the whole nation in noisy and abusive language. Then he gradually calmed himself and seemed more inclined to mildness when, as if struck by a bolt from the sky, he was seen to be speechless and suffocating, and his face was tinged with a fiery flush. On a sudden, his blood was checked and the sweat of death broke out upon him, and his servants quickly carried him away to an inner chamber where he passed away from apoplexy. So he burst a blood vessel in his brain and had a cerebral hemorrhage when he burst out with this fit of anger against the ambassadors of the Quadi.
Wow. That'll teach him.
Yes, a nasty man, but he has one of the most memorable death scenes for a Roman emperor, I think.
I thought it was going to be the bear came back and
died. Oh, that would have been great. If it had been Game of Thrones, he would have been eaten by his bear.
I would have adored him.
All right, that'll keep me going until 2025, till I get to that episode. Rhiannon, do you want to go now? Something with Seneca, you said?
Yeah, Seneca the Younger.
Yeah.
All right, so this is basically, I'm just going to quote from one of his letters.
What's he complaining about now?
Remember, Seneca is the advisor to Nero. It doesn't work out and ends up having to kill himself, instructed by Nero after the Pisonian conspiracy. He's a Stoic, and this becomes clear in his essays and also a series of letters allegedly written to Lucilius. Letter 18 has always fascinated me. We've talked about it before, actually, Matt, because it's a letter where he talks about the Saturnalia. I think we might have quoted directly from this.
Yes, yeah,
letter.
We did. Yeah.
And Seneca's not a fan. That's the one where he complains about the Saturnalia, and he complains it's taking over the whole month of December.
Yes.
Like, can't we just confine it to a week?
Yes.
And he goes on in that letter to talk about the virtues of poverty and the value of poverty and the value of experiencing poverty. And he says to Lucilius, this is what you should do, and this is what I do. Every year I just go off for a few days and act like a poor person. He says, set aside a certain number of days during which you shall be content with the scantiest and cheapest fare, with coarse and rough dress, saying to yourself the while, is this the condition I feared? This is letter 18, by the way, I should say. So he's basically saying, if you can do this for a few days, you know you can do poverty forever, which reminds me of, I don't know if this happens anymore, but in the 1980s, there were always, it was conservative politicians because they were in power, going and living on the dole, on Social Security for a week to show it could be done. Mm. Of course, living on it for a week is not like living on it for years. Mm. Months even. This is what I've always thought about Seneca, that it's all very well to say I can do it for, what does he say? I mean, it looks like it's about 3 or 4 days. But actually, that being your whole life. And Seneca does kind of admit this. First of all, he talks about why you do it, and it's basically for practice. He makes a comparison with what a soldier does. He says, in days of peace, the soldier performs maneuvers, throws up earthworks with no enemy in sight. So they're just practicing for when they have to be in that mode. And this is what you're doing. You're practicing in case it ever happens to you. Then he says, this is where I get the 3 or 4 days from, endure all this for 3 or 4 days at a time, sometimes for more. And Lucilius, you will understand that a man's peace of mind does not depend upon fortune, that you'll be fine if ever you have to be like this. I should also say for context that you might remember from, we talked about him a long time ago, but Seneca was the richest man in the Roman world, the kind of man who could lend to entire provinces. And yet he thinks that he could cope with poverty.
Yeah,
I think he probably couldn't cope with real poverty and no end to poverty. And he does sort of acknowledge that at the end. He says, there is no reason, however, why you should think that you're doing anything great, for you will be merely doing what thousands of slaves and many thousands of poor men are doing every day. He says at the end, however, we shall be rich with all the more comfort if we learn how far poverty is from being a burden. So he seems to almost get it that poverty is, it's a terrible grind. Mm. But he really thinks that he can know what it's like by experiencing it for a few days. And I just think this is self-deception of the highest order. Sorry, Seneca, I'm not buying it.
I mean, look, I'm defending Seneca here, but at least he's trying to think of it, not just, you know, sitting back on his lounge chair being bought grapes. And I'm sure he's getting that done as well, but at least he's trying to... No, anyway, I can't defend Seneca.
It's like the CEOs who sleep rough for a night or something that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. And I always imagine, and actually I've imagined this to the extent that I think I actually tell my students this, I must stop. Instead of having vast numbers of slaves, he's probably only got the one or two slaves looking after him during this period. He doesn't actually talk about whether he's got any attendants on him. Probably got a scribe writing this down for him after all. Anyway, I think Seneca's really interesting and I'm not having a go. And I sort of put that in there as a tribute to our friend of the show and previous guest, Peter Davis, who's an expert on Seneca. So I hope he won't be offended by what I've said about his man.
All right. We're finishing it on Nazis, guys.
Always right. Good place.
Okay. In 98 CE, the historian Tacitus wrote On the Origin and Situation of the Germans, which was a description of the lands, laws, and customs of the Germanic people. This text at the time was seemingly quite popular, but all copies were lost in the Middle Ages. But a single hand-lettered copy surfaced at an abbey in present-day Germany in 1455. Now, although Tacitus's descriptions of the Germanic people were not universally positive, he did admire them for their warlike qualities, and the books became an important part of Nazi ideology. So in 1924, young Heinrich Himmler read the Germania while on a train trip. In his diary, he wrote about the glorious image of the loftiness, purity, and nobleness of our ancestors. He vowed, thus we shall be again, adding the ominous note, or at least some among us. He was this fascinated with the Germania and the ideology of it, and the certain specific phrases just went so much through what was believed at Nazi Germany at the time, that he became fixated on that one text that was found in 1455. So in 1943, agents of Heinrich Himmler, the head of Hitler's SS at the time, second most powerful man in the Third Reich, tried to steal the one remaining copy, which had been hidden under the floor of a kitchen in Villan Fontedamo on the Adriatic coast of Italy. They broke down the doors, arrested the family within, ransacked the place, burnt half of it down, and did not find it. I like to think that they were thwarted by a young Princeton archaeologist named Indiana Jones, who made off with the text. It's known now it was hidden underneath the floorboards in that villa. It was in that villa, and then it was, you know, sent away and hidden and everything like that. And it finally, in 2009, made its way to Germany in an exhibition to mark the 2000th anniversary of Arminius's victory. There you go. And ironically, after all of that, Tacitus probably never visited Germania at all. So there
maybe
we go.
Not. There's a great book on that by Christopher Krebs called The Most Dangerous Book.
There is. There yeah. is. Stop yes. looking at my research.
Oh, sorry. You've read it. Sorry. If you wanted to do more.
So there we go. That's my last thing of interest.
It's truly terrifying what people can do with the texts from the ancient world.
I would be curious to think, you know, what would Tacitus think of this?
Well, you have to cherry pick. There's the line in there about the Germans being of pure blood. Not necessarily, you know, there for the Romans, really.
Yeah.
But he's got some pretty nasty things to say yes. about the Germans.
Yes, and they were very selective with how they interpreted it. But they had an institute set up to interpreting this text. So they took it pretty seriously because this is one of the only texts about what German origin is, if you think that those people are any relation to what current Germans are. Which is another thing that's open to interpretation. So there's this and Caesar.
Yeah, Caesar. They wouldn't have liked the Caesar stuff.
Caesar just goes on about how they've
got nothing.
They've got no wine.
They've got no gods. They've got no nothing. Even the Gauls are doing better.
Yeah. All right, of interest. Thank you very much to both of you.
You're welcome.
That's myself, along with Dr. Kaelin Davenport and Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please consider subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you may cast your pod. Please also leave a review. They are read and appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook. You can also follow all of us on Twitter. Have you got your pens ready? Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport. I am at Nightlight Guy. Don't ask. I have a very common name. Bow ties are cool. Let's just move on. And the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of the podcast, we'll be looking at medicine and health in ancient Rome. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You have been fantastic, and thanks for listening.